Alright everyone, it's the Grimlord here, and this is Grimm's Comics Corner with Clive Barker's Hellraiser Masterpieces, as requested on YouTube. Sorry it took so long, but we're going to get through it and read about 30 minutes of it, and we'll have the rest of it probably, let's see, Friday? Yeah, I could probably put it up Saturday. We'll read it Friday, finish it up. But alright, without further ado, let's begin. Volume 2. The Warm Red. Story by Bernie Wrightson. Colors by Bill Ray. And letters by Michael Heisler. All right. I'm telling you, it's the deal of the decade. You can't lose. So why sell it to me? Why not grab it yourself? Are you kidding? I've got a six-figure income to protect. One shot of my name on any deed within 50 miles of this project and zip. I might as well turn in my mouse ears. You're sure of your information? I got the green light this morning. We're doing it. Money back guarantee? Look, if you don't want in, sit down. Sure I want in. I just want to know I'm not wasting my money. It's a done deal. We're talking major acreage for the park itself, more than Anaheim, more than Orlando. Then you add hotels, restaurants, prices are going to hit the moon. Where? That's the $100 question, isn't it? Half now, half when the property sold, contingent on a 500% return on my net investment. That wasn't our deal. That's my deal. Call it insurance against loose lips. You're never happy without the other guy's balls in your pocket, are you, Maureen? Okay, you got it. Get out the map. Slick move, Maureen. If you're going to shell out 50 grand for a stupid map, you better learn to hang on to it. That's it. The place that's going to make little Maureen a millionaire, or a good percentage of one at the very least. One ramshackle farmhouse and a few hundred acres of stony ground that's about to be worth its weight in Mickey bucks. We're watching her, of course. What do you want? Oh, you surprised me. I didn't even knock. She has beautiful hands. Long, pampered hands. May I come in? My name is Maureen Endicott. You must be Brian Rhodes, right? How do you know my name? Matter of record, no big secret. This was a nice house once. You haven't kept it up too well, have you? I think you should leave. I'm sorry, that was rude. Please don't throw me out. Not yet. It ain't proper is all, us being here alone. Oh, I see. Smart. But really, Brian, I'm old enough to be your mother. Surely I'm safe. My mother was old. You're not like her. You're very pretty. You're lucky she's not around to hear you say that. I don't think she'd be too flattered. Don't be stupid. She's dead. How could she hear? Of course. Well, I'm flattered. Anyway, thank you. You're welcome. The fact is, Brian, it's been a long time since anyone called me pretty. These days I'm more frequently referred to as a handsome woman, and usually by some beer gut in a cheap suit trying to split my commission. Her skin is smooth, but pale. It wants a drop of color. Would you like a glass of lemonade? How's the farming, Brian? Been dry. I know, the whole state's ready to just dry up and blow away. What about the cattle? How many head did you bring to market this year?
None.
I'm sorry to hear that. I guess times have been tough, you could say. I think I could help you, Brian. I could get you a good price for this place, the house, and land.
How much?
Maybe $10,000 for the house. The land, I don't know. As much as $300 an acre, maybe with luck. That's a lot of money. I'm not making any promises I could get that much. It's a matter of finding the right buyers, parceling it out. Of course, I could buy it myself right now, all of it, for a little less. Not today. But you may not want to sell it all. Maybe when you and your girlfriend get married, you'll want a little...
I don't have a girlfriend.
Really? Why not? A fine, strong boy like you. Women don't like me much, I guess. You should go. I don't want the money. I don't want anything. Brian, I'm sorry. I didn't mean anything. It's just... A tiny sound, a rasp, a hiss, and warm red flowers... Let me do that again. A tiny sound, a rasp, a hiss, and warm red flows over the cool white. So lovely. So lovely. Her hands, smooth, white, cool. I like you, Brian. I think you're very attractive.
This is wrong. Mother wouldn't... Oh, Brian. What's wrong about it? We aren't going to do anything that hasn't been done before. You have done this before, haven't you? Yes, he has. It's so hot. I feel woozy. I said you should leave. I said you should. I've been waiting for you to wake up. You drugged me, son of a bitch. It's your fault. You made me feel that way. Now there's nothing to do but let things run their course. You're looking at my scars. They're old. I've had them for many years, ever since... Lie down, Brian, on the bed. Since before I found the box. I told you to go. I have to bring him here now. You should have left when I said. What is that thing? What are you doing? You'll see. The man's tortured, withering flesh is beginning to bore me. His mind is gone, incinerated in the endless repetition of death and rebirth. Blessed oblivion and dreadful awakenings. But now I feel the electric heat of the call. Praise Leviathan. Soon now I will enjoy a brief respite from the tedium of hell. Don't worry, my friend. We have time enough to finish before I leave. The disillusion of my own flesh delights me. The chaos of cellular agitation, the cacophony of life, is replaced with the pure mathematical orbits of electrons, the harmony of crystal, the sweet music of the subatomic spheres. It's been a long wait, Brian. My absence, inexcusably prolonged. One might think I wasn't welcomed. I materialize. The woman sees me and begins to scream uncontrollably. Hello, face. Brian. You've kept me waiting a long time. I'm sorry. I can see, you know, from the other side. You've had opportunities. I know. I'm sorry. I don't know where she gets the energy to scream like that. Always a scalpel, Brian is a creature of habit. Please! Shh! There's nothing to do about it now. I told you to leave and you didn't. Face is here now and it's too late. Face, please, listen! Whoever, whatever you are, listen to me. No time for talk, time to get to work. Please, Face, I'll make you a deal. Wait. Go ahead. I'm listening. It's about your partner here. He's a nobody. He's what we call a loser. He lives all alone, away from town, away from everybody. Keeps to himself. It's a wonder he ever gets anybody up to this dump. Shut up, or I'll... You'll what? Kill me? Let her finish. This place is going to be big, really big. 2 years from now, it'll be swarming with more people than that lame brain can count. They can be yours, Face. I promise it. I don't know how, but I'll find a way. They'll be yours. Don't listen to her, Face. She's lying. Don't listen to her. You said it yourself. He's missed opportunities. He's weak, Face. I'm strong. He doesn't know where he's going, what he wants. I've got plans, ambition. I can deliver you what you need. Shut up. You need a partner who's a winner. Don't saddle yourself with a loser. He's nothing. Less than nothing. Dump the retard. Let me take his place. I'll do more for you than he's ever dreamed of doing. She's lying. It's a trick to make us let her go. Don't believe her, Face. I think she means what she says. Face! Goodbye, Brian. It's been fun. But not nearly. Nearly enough. I didn't kill him, of course. I couldn't take Maureen's assurances at face value. After all, many things are promised under duress that cannot be delivered in reality. For Brian, it will be a return to his childhood. For me, a diversion. For her, it's a test. I told her to think of it as an audition. I told her to use her imagination, to have fun with the role. He begs, but she ignores him, studying his body carefully. Always, the hardest part is deciding where to begin. It's good that she's so meticulous. Ah, she's made her decision. Let's see what she does. The end. So, yeah. There we go. Clowning Around. Story by DJ Chichester. Art by Kyle Baker and letters by Phil Felix. When the show first ran back on Stanford Public Access Channel Q, the youthful audience waited in anticipation. Now it's trepidation. In those days, the program ran weekdays from between 4:30 and 5 o'clock, or 4:29 and 4:58, depending on whether or not the broadcast engineer tied one on the night before. Now it runs for eternity. Back then, the clown still had the illusion of hope, even as he hit a career gone nowhere behind cheap grease paint. These dark days, he smooths away the lines of humanity in his face, feeling nothing. Those days, then and now, only the smiles remain the same. Only the smile. Put on a happy face, indeed. Hey kids, it's the Mr. Winky Dink Show. They're the too innocent to be truly damned. Now, before we get started, let's take a moment to thank tonight's sponsor, Plenty, for everybody at Snack Time. Unwittingly drafted into a war of humanity in hell by appropriately childlike wonder over certain very peculiar puzzles. And look who's come to visit, our little pal, Mr. Dink. Everyone say, hey there, Mr. Dink. Wouldn't you know it, you just can't find good help these days. Where's Margaret Hamilton when you need her? Who can say for sure just what it was curiosity really did to the cat, but when it comes to these kids, well, why leave it to the imagination? They're in hell. What's with that look? Don't tell me you guys ain't gonna be any fun. I know, let's play a game. Volunteers? Hell, of course, has little use for such untainted souls running about its pits, causing all manner of chaos. Enter then Mr. Winky Dink, the soul, a rim shot here, if you please, sentinel watching over the lost boys and girls of the Inferno. It's that old favorite, the egg and spoon race. Beelzebub's bozo, if you will. Come on, let's show we're behind them. Let's give them a big hand, and a leg and a neck. They're gonna need them all, and some fingers, and... What's this? You don't look like you're enjoying yourselves. Good. Oh boy, it's story time. Now we left off last right after the children found out that their parents really didn't love them. Wah! Hey, quiet with that racket. Huh? Come on, guys, don't be like that. What do you say, a little magic cheer you up? A pinch of maggots, some roadkill, the valentines you sent to the other kids in second grade when nobody sent you any? And before you can say Penn and Teller, no, I don't wanna, you can't make me, you... Shh, go ahead, take a peek inside, please? See, nothing to be afraid of, just a little... Cocoon! Lord Leviathan, I can explain, This is now all there is, than having been lost long ago with so much else. This is now when a clown who juggles what he was with what he is smooths away the lines of humanity in his face again and again, until the performance where he finally gets it right and wipes it all away. Who's smiling now? Put on a happy face, indeed. The end. The Sweet Science. Story by Eric Salzgaber. Or Salzgaber? I don't know. Art by Mike Zeck and Phil Zimmelman. Letters by Ken Lopez. The Sweet Science. Don't get down to Red Hook much anymore. No point to it. But tonight it ought to serve my purposes. We don't mind you coming round here, homie. But breathing our air is going to cost you that shiny watch on your wrist. Good. This is what I came for. Last week it was Harlem. The week before, Bedford's Die. And Carnassy. The week before that. This is what I need. You want this watch, you're going to have to take it. I kind of doubt just the three of you can. Man, we'll kill you and think no more of it than taking a piss. Give up the watch and whatever cash you got. Kiss my ass. I hope this proves a greater challenge than my last outing. They call it the sweet science. The science part I understand. The shortest distance between two objects is a straight line. Mass times acceleration equals force. But sweet? Hey, that depends on which side you're looking at it from. Wait a minute, man. Who are you? Holy shit, the champ! That's right, Billy Moore, heavyweight champion of the world, beating up punks in Red Hook, having to fight two or three men at once, and they were still no more challenged than my last title defense. They say I'm better than Jack Johnson, better than Dempsey, Louis, Ali, and Tyson. I'm the greatest, most bored boxer in the world. Have a nice walk, champ? The best. I'm the heavyweight champion of the world, graduated cum laude from Cornell, and have an investment portfolio that makes Donald Trump envious. My equipment's all expensive national treasures. The gloves worn by Sugar Ray Robinson in his first title fight. I have one of the finest personal art collections in the world. I have all the money, titles, and material items anyone in the world could ask for. The training ring of the greatest fighter of all time from his final fight. I want for only one thing. The one thing I want I can't find. A challenge. I've beaten them all. Beating the best inside and outside of the ring. For a kid born and raised in the slums of Detroit, I've done all right. I've pushed my mind and my body to their limits. And then some, and I've reaped the rewards. Most boxers, they say, don't have my intelligence. They say I'm gifted. They think I'm cursed. I can see the limitations of my life, how little there is left for me to accomplish. So I fight two or three men at a time, street punks. Or I expand my holdings, do anything that might prove to be a challenge. And I dance here in the dark, working combinations, trying to solve the puzzle in my mind's eye that pits me against an opponent that demands all of my skill and resources to beat. I work the hands, I work the feet. I see my patterns evolving into more complex arrangements. I begin to see the puzzle unlocking. He's tough, I can see that. But I know that if I continue to work the combinations, I can take him. My moves will unlock the puzzle that sets him free. The feet, the hands, they're perfect tonight. The patterns are perfect. I've got it down, but it feels strange. Unnatural. What? You see, you got some nice moves. You put them together just right. You want to go a few rounds? Come on, boy. It's 14-14, and you know what to do in it. You said you wanted a challenge. I just might give you one. Besides, you got no choice. All right, you ugly son of a bitch. I don't know what's going on here, but if you think you can take this champ, you're going to learn different. Let's get it on. As we get into it, I start to understand, painful as it is, that he's better than me. And it becomes clear that he's the price I have to pay for my obsession. Huh? What are you? I'm a fighter, just like you. And I got bored, just like you. I never got knocked down, ever, not by anybody. You'll experience a lot of things here you never have before. Your moves were good, but somebody's are always better. Always. You have a long time to find that out. You wanted a challenge? You got forever to find your challenge. Maybe you'll prove yourself here too and we'll find a use for you. Then again, maybe not. What are you talking about? Oh no. The bell marking the beginning of eternity is about to sound. Oh wow, look at this. The end. The Tauntaun. Story by Scott Hampton. Art by Scott Hampton and John Van Fleet. Letters by John Costanza. The dream is always the same. I'm standing in black water. Who cools my face makes a whistling, wind cools my face, makes a whistling sound as it passes across the neat red hole at the center of my forehead. Reeds and tendrils of river grass bend away from me in the breeze like beckoning arms, urging me out of the shallows. I move slowly through the grass, feeling the cool water lap against my thighs, my belly, my chest. Then I am under, no struggling to breathe, watching as the milky cloud of long undisturbed sediment swirls about me in a mist, then slowly settles again. Then through the gray veil of water I see a face moving towards me, indistinct at first. The features slowly coalesce. I recognize Belasco as the gray deepens into black. Just the two of us now. 6 years, hard to believe it's finally coming to an end. Belasco set it all up back in 45. The war was coming to a close, and we were just dumb enough and crazy enough to go along with it. He called it a Tauntaun. None of us knew what that was, so he explained. Usually it's where everybody puts money into a pot and the last guy alive takes it all, but this game won't be for money. It'll be for something a lot more valuable. Every year from that day, we were to meet at an old gristmill his family owned in Wisconsin. Once there, we'd play the game. We'd do this only until one man was left. One. Beneficiary. Only the game was no game, it was Russian roulette. And when Belasco said lose, he meant it. But I'm getting ahead of myself. We were out there for a long time, and we generally pulled scouting details. We were lucky. almost too lucky. Our worst battle scars were calluses from the triggers of our Springfields. We couldn't buy a Purple Heart. It was uncanny. I remember a night when we were ordered to reconnoiter the fringe of a German outpost. The fringe of a German outpost. Landmines all over the place. The other guys didn't expect to see us again. And they were right. While we were crawling through the mud, feeling for metal prongs, we became aware of a low drone from overhead. A German squadron had chosen that precise moment to come crawling. By the time we got back, there was nobody left to report to. Belasco was the squad leader, and he always took point. Nothing seemed to worry him. I've never known anyone who was less afraid of dying. Before every mission, he'd pull out an odd gun. I didn't know the make. He said he bought it in Naples. Spin the chamber. Place the muzzle against his temple and pull the trigger. Carr called him on it one night. He said, "Hell, boy, everybody knows that thing ain't loaded." And then he laughed. We all did. Belasco smiled for a moment. Thunk! Then before Carr knew what was happening, braced the muzzle of the gun against his forehead and pulled the trigger. He had to hold Carr back. He called Belasco a crazy son of a bitch. Tried to get at him, but Belasco only smiled. He pointed the pistol at a rat that had made its way into the foxhole and blew its head off. Everybody got very quiet then. Belasco left. It was a flat, dead sound. He reloaded, spun the chamber again. Then he laid the gun down in front of us all. That was the beginning. A gauntlet had been thrown down. A challenge to manhood. A challenge accepted. We didn't realize that first time that we would grow to actually look forward to it, to need it. We were soldiers. Someone had said, you commit to the kill or you die. And we were committed. We killed men comfortably from a distance, and we killed them brutally at close quarters. We were becoming numb. That game brought us back, set our nerves on fire. Spinning the chamber, lodging the gun against your head. You could feel the blood drumming and your temples pounding. 1 in 6. Those were your chances. It became our drug, equal parts terror and exhilaration. Needless to say, by the night we agreed to the compact, I think we were all at least a little insane. That night, each of us in turn cut our forearms, mingling our blood in an old K-rash and tin. Then we sat in a circle and passed the tin around. Each man in turn took a sip, then passed it on, ending with Belasco, who drained it. Then he placed the familiar gun in front of us and said, "It's time to put away childish things. The war was coming to an end. The addiction was all we had left." "I'll go first," said Carr as he reached for the pistol. No one was surprised. Carr was a superstitious gambler and he believed in lucky rolls. He wanted to go first because he'd never gone second. Carr's attitude was different from mine. I remember thinking about all the times I'd heard the cylinder slowly turning to meet the hammer. The hollow clack that told me it was still there. We'd been jeering at death for months, but he'd been too busy to bother with us. Now the fighting was almost over and Carr was about to thumb his nose one more time. Only this time, death was there to see it. I was sure that Carr was going to put a bullet through his head, but I was wrong. When he finished, he laid the gun down with a look of satisfaction. A look that said, "Kid stuff," as if he knew it would happen that way. Dorn was about to pick up the gun, but Belasco beat him to it. As he put the gun to his head, he said something I'll never forget. He said, "See ya." The blast was deafening in that small space. Did he know? Did he want to die? Ian Belasco, the man with all the answers, wasn't saying. We all met at Belasco's gristmill up in Wisconsin, 40 miles out in the woods, down torturous dirt roads, mushy with mud and patches of gray snow. Belasco was there too. He wouldn't miss this for the world. Once inside, we were surprised to discover a large Victorian table with 6 chairs neatly arranged around it, standing in the middle of the room except for these. The place was empty, gutted. Miller pulled the gun from his new leather satchel, while Carr lit a kerosene lamp that he brought and placed it on the center of the table. I was elected to put the bullet in the chamber. I remember the cold feel of the cylinder against my palm, the clicking, ratcheting sound it made as it spun, then slowed and finally stopped. Carr spun the revolver and my heart hammered like a fist inside my chest as the gun slowed and slowed and passed me for the last time to point at Miller directly across from me. He picked it up by the barrel first, then turned the walnut handle into his palm and looked around at us. Then, Frowning with determination, he quickly pointed the tip of the barrel at his temple, as though he'd already thought about it, already decided to point it there. His finger tensed and the cylinder started going around, the hammer drawing back as he tightened on the trigger. I remember mostly that hammer, that huge hammer going up, and back. When he seemed as though it might go on rising all night, it dropped. It dropped, and Miller's brains exploded out the other side of his head, splattering the rotten timbers of the wall behind him. The blast had forced his left eye from its socket, and it hung down on his cheek like a ripe plum. Somehow, though, the distorted features still registered surprise, almost as if he didn't realize he was dead. Then everybody started moving. Carr pried the gun out of Miller's grasp. No one spoke while Carr and I tied cinder blocks to him with baling wire, then waded out into the tarn that once had been a stream and sank the dead man in black water. Jennings started Miller's Chevy and drove it in as well. Then we all left. The relief, the exhilaration hit me on the way back. I drove all night, never let the speedometer drop below 80. As Belasco had promised, my fortune seemed to double afterwards. Just as they had after he'd gone, it was as if each of us inherited a share of the dead man's luck. And something else, something more valuable. His discarded life force, his ability to dupe death. When I returned to that dilapidated building the next year, I experienced a feeling of having returned through time. The room was unchanged, exactly as we'd left it. I half expected Miller to walk in. His chair remained empty, thank God. And that grim difference began to dissolve my feelings of deja vu. The spinning of the gun eliminated them all together. This time it pointed dead at me. Suddenly I was scared, more scared than I'd ever been before. Because now I had something to lose, I suppose. The gun felt heavy and cold in my hand as it pressed against my temple. It hadn't seemed hard to lift, but now that it was there, it took incredible strength to hold it in place and fight the urge to simply drop it on the floor. I realized then that I hadn't checked the damn thing to see that there was indeed only one bullet in it. How did I know I could trust Carr and his gun? Suppose he'd put that single bullet in the only empty chamber. But then I thought he wouldn't have done that. Suppose the gun had pointed at him. The handle was beginning to grow warm and slippery, and the weight of it kept increasing. Trying not to think about Miller, I tightened my grip on the trigger. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw my knuckles getting white, and I could feel the scraping of the mechanism inside the gun. And then there was the hollow click of the copper firing pin coming down on nothing. I was glad I hadn't examined the gun to see where the bullet was. I may have even smiled, broken into a stupid grin as I blew out my breath, grinning to still be alive. The others weren't grinning. They looked a little gray in the lamplight, and I remember there was a slight tremor in the hand I passed the gun to.
Jennings shrieked like a commando taking the hill when he did it. Young, as usual, said nothing, just pointed the gun and slowly squeezed the trigger.
I was beginning to wonder if maybe Carr had played a joke on us and put the bullet in his pocket while we weren't looking. Then he picked up the pistol, and I could tell from the expression on his face that this wasn't a joke. Carr's hand shook as he pointed the gun to his head. We knew the odds now were exactly so-so, but they probably felt more like 80-20 against a Carr. The bullet had been in that gun too long. It was time for it to come out. We were all thinking it. It was hard to imagine if you'd never done it. How difficult it is to actually pull that little steel stub inside the finger guard when the gun is against your temple. No amount of oil helps in your own hand and pointed at your own head. The trigger always seems to drag and scrape. Shoving every natural instinct inside, Carr squeezed his eyes shut and forced the trigger back. The unbearable copper firing pin came down on nothing once more. Carr snatched the gun away from his head and exclaimed, "Yeah!" grinning from ear to ear. Then, since we weren't grinning back, he stopped and looked at Dorn. But Dorn wasn't looking at us just then. He was looking at the gun on the table in front of him. Nothing changed when he picked up the gun. There was no tremor in his hand, no lock on his face to betray his state of mind. He just held the gun for a long time, saying nothing and sort of hefting it in his hand as if he were weighing it. And there must have been a little water in the kerosene because the lantern flame made a popping sound just as he started to raise the gun. That's how quiet it was. It was then that the full horror of what we'd been doing struck me. I wanted to stop him. I wanted to say, the hell with Belasco. We're too old for this. Let's go home. But I couldn't produce a sound or move a muscle. I couldn't even blink. I watched in mute horror as Dorn opened his mouth and stuck the 4-inch barrel inside against his roof. Against the roof, rather. And still those eyes looked straight out. It was like he'd forgotten we were there. Instead, he was staring right into that gray window overlooking the tarn. Finally, he pulled the trigger, not slowly, but with a tug that took no time at all, the way a strong man might pull his own tooth. The blast snapped his head back and to the side, spun him around. Death struck Dorn down the way another man might, with a roundhouse to the head knocking him off his chair. In an instant, there was nothing left, no blood, no evidence of his ever having been there, except for the sound of his body thrashing beneath the table. And then that stopped. Then there was nothing. Dorn's death bothers me yet. He was the best of us, the one who enjoyed dodging bullets the least, and the one most likely to lay down his life for you. In spite of everything, he was an honorable man. After that, the excitement, the perverse thrill was gone, and I never wanted to do it again. But I had to. Dorn had died for that stale maxim, a deal's a deal, and I knew I wouldn't be able to live with myself if I backed out, so I went. After Dorn, a year passed like a week, and I'd find myself around that crummy table with those guys again. 48 was Jennings, and it was over pretty quickly. He was the first man up, like Miller. Jennings had brought a Cadillac that year, and Carr balked at driving it into the tarn. He said it was such a waste, so I did it. Then Young in 49. There was one odd moment that year. It came when Carr was handing the pistol to Young. I was sitting in the chair facing the window, the one Dorn had been in 2 years earlier. As I watched the gun being passed, my eye was drawn to a shadowy figure near the edge of the tarn. He seemed to be watching us, not moving, just standing there, watching. I was about to say something, warn Young when the gun went off. He took longer than anyone else, 3-4 minutes to die. When I looked up again, the figure was gone. It's 1950 now, and the Tontite is coming to its end. Today, one of us gets to find out if Belasco was on the level or not. I'm tired now, tired of wondering, tired of worrying about it. I don't even know if I want it anymore. Today decides the matter one way or the other. I'll just be glad when it's over. Blam! Light one for me while you're at it. Take this one. I was wondering when you'd show. What was the holdup? Preparations. You look like hell. Is that supposed to be a joke? Thanks. Have you got the gun? Here. It seems to have changed. Regained its true shape. Where's Carr? In there with the others. Good. One more drag for Auld Lang Syne and we'll go. You ready? Sure. The end. Wow, that was kind of like Deader. You know, Hellraiser Deader? Baby Cakes. Story by Faye Parzich. Art by Gary Talalak. And letters by Phil Felix. 9 months. 9 months of whiteness and loneliness and feeling the child grow inside her. 9 months of waiting. Waiting to see him, to touch him, to receive what he had promised to give. No fear, just 9 months. It would be soon. The men of her world could not give her a child. Oh, she tried. They failed. The doctor said she was barren. The adoption agencies didn't have babies for a woman with no husband. And the black market didn't have babies for a woman with no money. But there was still one place she hadn't tried. Hell. She knew of the Cenobites, knew what they could do, what they were capable of. They had children. Perhaps they could give her one. Perhaps they could make a deal. Or perhaps she could find an extraordinary Cenobite. If she could solve the puzzle, open the gates to him. One with whom she could produce an extraordinary child. Well, another lost lamb. Didn't take you very long. You must have been in a hurry. What is it you want? I see. Many experiences are possible. What exactly do you want? I want a child. Child is possible. Many children are possible. Yes, many children. Many children. Make yourself ready to receive the first child. Ready when you are. Oh, I'm always ready. No! This was not what she had expected. It was certainly not what she wanted. 9 months. A long time to wait. She could feel his fingers working inside her. It would be very soon. but she would soon be the mother of an extraordinary child. Ah, ready to come out of the oven, my precious? Ah, perfect. Let me see my baby. No! It is indeed an extraordinary child. It is a Cenobite, but it is also a lament configuration, all rolled up in one tidy package. Properly handled, your children will open the doorway to a new realm in hell. Aren't you proud? Yes, make another. No, please, no! Another 9 months, and another, and another. But then she'd had plenty of time. All the time in hell. The end. That was crazy. First, we have Homecoming. All right. On that note, I think we're going to go ahead and end it. Because, you know, we got quite a bit more, but we're only doing about 30-so minutes of it. And we'll see you next time on Grimm's Comics Corner with more Hellraiser masterpieces.